Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte, and when I'm not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, restaurateurs, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. Today, we'll have on two chef friends talking about cooking for the ultimate VIPs, daughters, and the Holy Father, celebrity chef and restaurateur, Yugoslavian immigrant and Catholic, Lidia Bastianich, up first on cooking for Pope Francis during his visit to New York City last Friday. What do popes eat? How do you even decide what to serve? And then second, live in studio, we've got three-time James Beard Award winner Michael Anthony. He's an executive chef and partner of Gramercy Tavern, as well as executive chef and managing director of Untitled and Studio Cafe at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Plus, his second cookbook, V is for Vegetables, is out in just 3 weeks, and we get a preview. We'll also talk his career start in Japan, his generations-long obsession with garlic, and cooking with his three daughters. It's the P is for Pope, V is for Vegetables episode of Word of Mouth. And with that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like. Lidia Bastianich, the Pope's chef. Hello, Lidia.
Hi, lady. How are you doing?
So great. So exciting. What an incredible opportunity. I want to share with you where I was last Friday. I was on a plane when the Pope descended upon New York City, and I watched the 9/11 memorial service, so beautiful. And then all I could think about was what did he do the rest of the day, and what did he eat? So I was so excited to learn that you were his chef.
Yes, lady. For the 40 hours that he was in New York City, myself with a team, you know, it was Angelo Vivolo, was my chef from Felidia, Fortunato Nicotra, my daughter Tanya. It takes a team to make a whole thing work. But yes, his meals in New York, two breakfasts, one lunch, and two dinner, we cooked for him.
What did you cook?
Well, you know, when we first found out, when we were first asked about 6, 8 months ago, the thoughts went, well, he's Argentinian, big pieces of meat, we're going to do a roasted prime ribs of beef or so on, we're going to bring the whole carré out. Well, none of that happened. His request, was very simple, was very seasonal, not elaborated at all. And I loved it because, you know, I like to cook that way, and Italian food is that way. So Friday, one of the days was Friday. Of course, we stayed with fish. Long Island striped bass, fresh Long Island striped bass caught by the fishermen, roasted in the oven with a little parsley, olive oil, and a little bit of lemon juice. He is from the part of Italy that's Piemontese. They do a lot of rice. He loves rice. And we made a risotto. We made it for his team. He had usually 12 to 14 people at the table. And for his team, we made a risotto. For them, we put the truffles and a little bit of porcini in there. For him, simple in bianco, white risotto with onions, some grana padano on top of it. He ate a plate full of that. He really loved it. You know, traveling, restorative soup is restorative, so I made a big pot of capon soup. I served it to him twice. Mm-hmm. Once I served it with vegetables, and another time I cook rice in it because he likes rice. Even dessert, we kind of went light. We made an angel food cake. I mean, how do you like that? Angel food cake with Concord grape sorbet. And he really liked that.
Seasonal, local. I also heard that the Pope has doctor's orders to lose weight, like all of us.
Yeah, I think many of us are on that list. But I wasn't told that. There was a doctor always with him, but then there's always a doctor that travels with him.
Interesting.
And, the requests were, simple. Minimize the sauces at all time. We had a wonderful appetizer of tutto tonno, all tuna. So we did tuna three ways on a bed of tonnato sauce, because tonnato is Piemontese, the sauce. For him, we did a grilled tuna with minimal of sauce. So we adjusted each plate for him the way that it was told and that he wanted it, I guess his doctor recommended. So he ate good, he ate deliciously, but he ate with, we watched as far as the fats and the calories. What we did, I'll tell you. The last night, I made an open apple tart.
Yes.
Apples are just coming in. It's very New York, upstate. And so the crust was delicious, but what he did, he spooned out, he ate all of the apples in a minimal part of the crust. So he was watching.
Cooking for the Pope holds special meaning for you because you are Catholic, and in fact, your family fled Yugoslavia after World War II, and you were brought to the U.S. by Catholic charities.
Right, the Catholic Relief Services at that time, and then I guess the Catholic Charities really helped us. After World War II, the part that we lived was Italy, was given to Yugoslavia, and we fled back into Italy and ultimately came here as immigrants. And the Catholic Relief Services did take care of us, of our trip. They brought us here. We had nobody here. They found a home for us. They found a job for my father. So absolutely, it has a lot of meaning. And, in retrospect, I was thinking what he was saying about the immigrants. Mm. And, it really touched to my heart that, we really need to be conscious and help the people that need help, give love. Because, I was one of those people mm-hmm. that was helped by other people. So I really feel it.
And without you, we would be lacking in so much deliciousness in life.
So thanks, Leida.
Conversations around the dinner table. What did you talk to him about?
Well, it wasn't that I was, there talking to him at his table. He had his these were actually his confidants, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I was basically in the kitchen. My daughter and Angelo Viola were serving, but I think the conversations were mostly about the days and what they're going to do and the timings. And, the one beautiful part, though, when he first came in. So, Lady, you got to imagine this. Mm-hmm. This is in a townhouse on 72nd Street, which is the nuncio's home. That's the ambassador of the Vatican to the United Nations. So it is like a private home. And he slept upstairs. He had his little chapel and everything. The second floor, we had the dining room. And on the first floor was the entrance and the kitchen. So when he came in with his luggage, it's like family's coming. So it was really, really moving because very close quarters. We said hello to him. He blessed us all. And then he went upstairs and rested. And from then on, I thought, we're going to see him when again. He's going to thank us when he leaves. Mm-hmm. But one afternoon, Friday afternoon, after lunch, he had taken a little rest. All of a sudden, the Secret Service man ran in the kitchen and says, the Pope is coming. So don't you think? We were just five of us in the kitchen. It was beautiful. He came at the door, and he looked at us, and he said, grazie mille, era buonissimo. Posso avere un caffè con voi? May I have a coffee with you? Mm. Can you imagine? The Pope came in the kitchen. We gave him an espresso. No sugar. He wanted no sugar. We offered him to sit down on the stool. He didn't want to sit down, but he blessed us. He asked about our lives, what we do. And he was so appreciative. And when he left, he said, pray for me. So it was very moving. We were all teary-eyed when he walked out that door, let me tell you.
Hmm. And you are the Pope's chef in New York City. Not a lot of folks know that you also cooked for Pope Benedict in 2008.
I did.
In case we want to get into the kitchen and start practicing now, how do you get selected for the honor?
Again, my background and hence I do a lot of volunteer work and this Angelo Vivolo, who is a restaurateur as well. We did a lot of fundraising for UNIFEM, the United Film Organization, at the United Nations, and hence we met the then Nunzio Celestino, and that's when we sort of connected. He saw that we really do it with the heart. We mean what we do, and of course my cooking skills had something to do with it, and that's who first asked us, would we cook for Pope Benedict, and that's how the door opened, and you create a relationship, and we went in the same home at the Nuncio's house on 72nd Street, and we cooked for Pope Benedict throughout his visit here in New York City. So I am blessed over and over again.
You've cooked for a bunch of celebrities and dignitaries before. Do you ever get nervous?
You do get nervous, especially before the planning, and especially even the first time. Oh my God! What is it going to be? What would they want, and whatever. In the Pope's case, you sort of once we know what he really wants, and we have the information, the rest is not really difficult. And especially once I'm in that kitchen, there's a serenity, a peacefulness that comes. I guess maybe it's the faith, it's the thought, it's the reality of being in such close proximity. But I cooked with all the serenity of my heart, with a great feeling and great joy. And I had not only all the help, but I also had both of my children there to help. So Tanya, my daughter, who worked in the dining room, and Joe, who helped with the wine, so it was wonderful.
All in the family. Is there somebody you still want to cook for that you haven't gotten to yet?
There's not a particular person that I'd like to cook for, but I would like to cook when I see those hungry children in Africa, and I see their poor little bellies all swollen with all kinds of parasites and whatever. I wish I could be there. I wish I could make them a soup. I wish I could make them some great pasta or vegetables. And maybe someday I hope that I could give my skills for something like that.
Thank you so much, Lydia, for joining us today on Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much, Layla, for having me.
Go immigrants. Bye.
Thanks, Layla. Bye-bye.
After this quick commercial break, we'll have here live in the studio Chef Michael Anthony at the helm at Untitled at the Whitney and at the New York City Institution Gramercy Tavern. Stay tuned.
Listening to Balloons by Jack Inslee. This is Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leyte Su, that's L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U. We're at Heritage_Radio. And you can find us at the hashtag WOMSHOW, WOM Show. You can also hit subscribe and listen to the show anytime, anywhere through iTunes or Stitcher. If you do love Word of Mouth, please rate and review us. And if you hate us, you can keep that your own dirty little secret. Next up, live in studio, we have Michael Anthony, chef and partner at Gramercy Tavern, managing director at Untitled in the Whitney Museum. People we like. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good. So this has been quite a roller coaster year for you.
Yes, it has. It's been pretty crazy. We've had a lot of fun.
We got the win for Outstanding Chef, James Beard Awards 2015. And then we've got your brand spanking new book. In fact, it's not even out yet. It's out in 3 weeks.
That's right.
And then the opening of Untitled.
Amazing.
To much acclaim.
Very proud of our team there.
So thanks so much for taking the time to come out here. What, besides everything, is hard about having three restaurants and three daughters?
Working in restaurants needs no explanation. It's a challenge, that's for sure. It was a liberating process to get to be a part of the new project at the Whitney. We've made a ton of new friends in the museum organization. Our restaurant company has experienced all kinds of amazing new learning opportunities through growing. People who have worked at Gramercy Tavern for years have stepped up into new roles of responsibility, and they're flying with that new responsibility. Suzanne Cupps is the chef de cuisine of Untitled and Studio Cafe, and Gia San Angelo is the general manager of those restaurants. Julia Travis is an incredible new leader to our organization. Do you hear a lot of women's names in these
which we're gonna
positions
do
of power?
A women episode.
So we're really proud. Untitled also gives us a chance to talk about the evolution of the cooking that started at Gramercy Tavern, and really it has enabled us to focus on our love of vegetables. And in some ways, the preparation for that restaurant sparked this incredible idea to do a cookbook, not about the restaurant, but all about cooking at home and sharing the inspiration of cooking with vegetables. Not uniquely vegetarian or vegan, but really about the inspiration that a cook feels when you're walking through the Green Market or working in the garden or visiting a farm. The sense of how do we translate the cool textures, colors, sizes, shapes of seasonality, right? The menu at Gramercy Tavern is all about seasonal cooking. The menu at Untitled and Studio Cafe changes literally from day to day with the changing weather. And one of the easiest ways that we can distinguish that kind of cooking is through the use of vegetables. That was the heart of the message of this book, V is for Vegetables, was all about sharing that excitement and enthusiasm. A lot of chefs write books and say, yeah, it's really simple. And we know they're lying.
They're super lying. It's like, yeah, it's actually quite, it's actually, thank you so much for that.
It's not meant to be a lie. Nobody means to lie. They're, you know,
no one ever means to lie. No one ever means. But, you know, I the book is, let's describe it. It's this like beautiful tome. It's, you know, vegetables from A to Z, which makes it already very user friendly. Your tone is very funny. There's plenty of exclamation marks.
Yeah, you were
excited about vegetables.
The voice was really about saying that, you know, cooking's not a spectator sport. Michael Pollan's given us the gift of, you know, that phrase. It's true that, you know, as people get more and more excited about food, we don't want to leave it in the hands of someone else. We want to encourage people to say and feel emphatically that they can do it. And throughout this book, there are a lot of statements of, you know, read this book, trust your intuition, pick up a few tips, try it like this. Don't worry about mistakes. You're going to get this right.
And every recipe is like a couple lines long. It's really fabulous.
Cool. We had fun making this book together with the same team that did the Gramercy Tavern cookbook, and Dorothy Kalins, who is a masterful storyteller and credible co-author.
A friend of Danny Meyer's, right?
Close friend of Danny's and our restaurant. She has become our mentor and fairy godmother all in one. And
you know what's really interesting about the book is you shot the photos at home, right?
In Dorothy's
home. Dorothy's home. Because her home is better than your home.
Well, we live, you know, two floors apart, which is
really
ironic. We live in the same building.
Oh, okay. Cool. So why did you guys pick her home and not yours?
She has a better kitchen than I do.
Got it. Okay. All right.
And she has an amazing kitchen. We transformed. Plus, I think her husband, Roger Sherman, was just kind enough to let us transform their home into a studio.
Yeah, a crazy town.
One of the powerful things about this book is we literally cooked the dishes. There was a little bit of pressure on cooking for someone like Dorothy, mm-hmm. Maura McAvoy, Kathy Brennan, this amazing star-studded team of people working together. And not only did we have to get it right for the sake of the book and the people who are going to use the book, but literally we would sit down and eat for lunch all of the dishes that I would cook. And there was some pressure to get it right. These are people who are enthusiastic eaters. They know all about food. And so I think it was actually, all kidding aside, it was really one of the sources of kind of quality and inspiration in doing these recipes. There were a lot of cooks who had a hand in the soup. Sue Lee, my assistant in the kitchen, who is experienced and wonderful. Kathy Brennan, also a cookbook author herself, mm-hmm. Was our recipe tester. Dorothy, who has an immense experience of not just telling stories, but of cooking. And so we all really had a little, we added our point of view to, are these recipes really designed? So one, they taste great. Two, they'll share the enthusiasm and the inspiration by, you know, focusing on dishes that are all about vegetables. And three, are they really set up so somebody at home in a normal kitchen
cannot mess it up?
Well, would just do it. Do you have time to do it? Do you feel confident enough to do it? Do you feel like this is enticing enough to do it? And these recipes are really emphatically made for the home cook. So that they listen. I have three daughters. All right. So we asked ourselves the question.
They're very judgy.
They are very discerning diners.
What is it like cooking for them?
It's tough business. Being the cook's a hard job. It is a hard job anywhere, whether you're a professional chef or a home cook.
So what happens when you bring home like that box of like Norwich Meadows CSA?
Yeah. Thanks.
I mean,
first of all, it's one of our greatest pleasures. You know, the discovery of reaching in that box and pulling out these interesting shapes and colors.
Yeah, but you feel
saying,
that
like,
way,
look
though.
At this.
You feel that
well,
way.
Well, the kids look at it, and sometimes the look is blasé, and sometimes it's like, oh, that's cool, Dad. and then sometimes it's like, hey, let me hold that for a while. And you know what? It is an endless battle. You don't always win every single one of the fights. But it's listen, if we make it part of our lives and it's truly a source of pleasure, then it sticks at some point. You don't have to force anybody into cooking and eating the way you see fit, but it's sharing that excitement and enthusiasm. Sometimes it rubs off.
You said something really cool to me once, which is that cooking is the last central acts we're allowed in modern civilized American society.
Yeah.
And I've like since then, like it's just like, oh my God, that's true, because we're not allowed sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's just cooking. And now, like, now it's not just women who find it sexy to cook. It's like men, too. Men want to be in the kitchen.
It is a great chance to express our hedonistic tendencies. That is for sure.
One really fun detail from the book is you talk about certain little, like, very simple concepts that that have helped me to understand why your food is so delicious. For instance, food not being wet enough, which is like something you would never find, like you wouldn't get that in French, you know, cooking school. I don't think. I mean, I haven't really heard that, but I totally agree with you. I like my food all like sufficiently moist, and it's
right.
This weird thing. I don't know.
Well, so here's the thing with vegetables. The success of a dish is really hinging in a large part to how much or how little liquid you add to the recipe. And in some cases, there are certain, depending on the vegetable, like a tomato, sometimes the key is not adding liquid because you want to concentrate flavors and develop, you know, intensity through reduction. Other vegetables, you know, like a leek, benefits from very little liquid because you want to concentrate on caramelization of flavors, and that's what's the most amazing thing about that vegetable. But sometimes ingredients like mushrooms or onions or kohlrabi need a surrounding sauce, little bit of help, something. Beans, like I love eating shell beans. As a kid, not so much. I was one of the toughest eaters around.
Yeah, you were a nightmare as a kid.
Oh, I was terrible. But when I grew up and started traveling and exploring.
But what were you really like as a kid, though? Like, what were you like at the dinner table?
I played sports. Like, I was into, like, eating as fast as I could and getting up and running back outside.
Okay.
So, no, food was, I mean, we had some great traditions. I come from an Italian-American family, and Sunday nights were always at my grandparents' house, which, as a kid, I will admit, was not my first choice. But it was, you know, made for great memories, made me understand, you know, the value of spending time with your family. Then, as a kid, I was not excited about the idea
of
sitting
at
the table.
You were massively picky.
Oh, completely. If food touched each other on the plate, it was finished for me. So when I grew up a little bit and started traveling and exploring the world and probably starving in the process is when I started to, get excited about how, you know, eating what people eat is a window into the way they live and the way they are. And the more you travel, the more you realize people are very similar. They have different customs, but their needs are the same.
Everyone's got a dumpling.
Yeah.
Of some sort.
Man, we have a great dumpling in this book. We made excellent gyoza in this.
Oh yeah, it's in the first half of it. I remember because I read the first half.
This book is mostly about the idea of cooking ingredients that are from here, but we're not turning ourselves off to ideas that come from all over. It's emphatically an American cookbook, but it does not limit the ideas that bubble up from all of our experiences.
Right, because you started cooking in Japan.
I did, yeah.
Under a woman chef.
That's right.
Shizuo Oshima.
Bistro Oshima in Roppongi. It was a French-Japanese restaurant. I had finally decided after I graduated from college what I really wanted to do with my life, or at least what I was going to try. I wasn't sure once I got into that experience that I would come out alive. It was a tough experience. It was an old school mentality of teaching me how to think like a cook and to work like a cook, thinking ahead, choosing the right tool, always, always working cleanly. And some of those most basic rules, I refer to them every single day at work. At the time, I wasn't really sure that I was going to come out alive. It was a difficult experience.
So, your career almost ended right where it began.
It almost ended in the first few weeks.
How did you end up at meeting Shizuo Oshima?
Well, so...
And do you refer to her in the Japanese kitchen as Shima-san or...
Sensei.
Sensei. Okay, right, because it's extra senior.
Sensei is teacher. It's officially master.
Okay.
It's Shima Sensei. An honorific, yes. So I met because I had decided that what I would try to do is study Japanese study Japanese cooking, go to the Tsuji Cooking School in Osaka. And I explained to her in Japanese, it was clear enough that I wouldn't get in the way. I would work hard and stay diligent. And she held me to it. But then a year and a half later, after working for her, she said, okay, I've taught you everything I know, and it's time for you to leave. And I was like, leave? Like, you're kicking me out. She's like, no, it's time for you to move on. And that's different than getting kicked out. I said, okay. And she goes, you're going to Paris. And I was like, no, my plan is to go to Osaka. This is what I've been working for. No, that's not a good plan. If you love Japan so much, you can always come back. And I have as a visitor, but I've never really, you know, my career took another direction. And I can't say that it was for the worse. She was amazing. She actually followed up and came to Paris twice to introduce me to her mentor and also to make sure that I wasn't screwing around. So it was a great way to get in the business with someone who was so difficult but so adamant about, you know, doing things the right way. It was great. And in life, you never really know when you're going to run into people that push you along. So if there's anything that I learned from her is that, you know, we kind of have a responsibility in this industry to, you know, to create more avenues than roadblocks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no real way to say thank you to people. You just have to do it for somebody else.
Do you still stay in touch?
Yeah, I was in Tokyo 3 years ago, and we were cooking at the Tokyo Park Hyatt at the New York Bar and Grill on the 52nd floor. You know that open kitchen?
Yeah.
It looks out over the whole city.
It's like been a lot of films. It's been in that one.
Lost in Translation.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
It's a great place. We were very welcome there. We cooked a tasting menu for a week, and it was a tremendous experience. I introduced my two sous chefs to Tokyo and to places where I lived and worked and enjoyed spending time, and to introduce them to Shima-san. And so we talked her into staying for the meal. It was really funny because she sat and smiled as I brought her each dish. And then I would walk away from her table and she would say, "Excuse me, 1 second, please." And she would call me back to the table with some helpful hint or constructive criticism about each and every dish. And there was not one single piece of food that went by her without a little comment. And at least it's true to form. She is amazing. She's a very open, earnest, and honest person. So it made me feel tremendously proud.
Has she eaten at Gramercy Tavern and Untitled?
I don't think she's ever been. She may have come to the States before I knew her, but not since we've known each other.
What do your mom and dad, what did they do?
My parents were teachers. My dad was a principal. My mom was a teacher. And, you know, it's funny because getting into this business, I really think that education is ultimately what kind of keeps me connected to this business. Of course, we're students of food and we love the, you know, the rush of making people happy. But the reality of it is that we're always thinking about what we do in the framework of education. So whether it's very literally at work in terms of training and teaching people how to do what we do, or more figuratively in terms of teaching people how to fall in love with what we do and why we've fallen in love with doing this day in and day out. We teach kids. We spend a lot of time at elementary schools in our neighborhood. We help teach people who are sick, and we cook for them. And
with God's love, we deliver.
Exactly. It's one of New York's great organizations that not only feeds people who can't take care of themselves, but they are very mindful about what they feed people. They're very sincere and have actually funded studies to explore how healthy, nutritious, delicious food can actually reduce the readmission rate to hospitals and ultimately impact the health of people across our country, and especially for those who are most in need.
God's Love, We Deliver is not as, I know we just talked about the Pope and everything, but not as God-oriented as it sounds.
It's not a religious organization.
Okay.
The name comes from the founder who crossed paths with a priest in her neighborhood who noticed that on a daily basis she was making her way across the neighborhood to the same building with food. And he said, "By the way, what do you have in there?" And she said, "Well, I'm making dinner for my neighbor who's too sick to leave his apartment." And he said, "Well, that's not food. That's God's love you're delivering."
Oh,
that's
wow.
Where the name comes from.
So where is this food being cooked, and it's still being delivered all over New York, in the New York area?
God's Love We Deliver is located at 6th Avenue and Spring Street. And they have a brand new Michael Kors Center, which is a gorgeous new building with a tremendous 40,000 square foot production facility. They cook for 12 million people a year. It is one of New York's proudest institutions and growing.
Chef Mike and I are going to collaborate on a hospital food initiative.
I know that you're interested in that story.
Yeah.
And the idea of not only sharing food with those who are in need, but picking up the subject of how to share healthy food, how to pay attention carefully to not just what's nutritionally necessary, but how to make food attractive. When you're sick, some of the hardest things to do is to find your appetite.
Yeah.
And especially when you're in the hospital, these days, unfortunately, one of the hardest things to do is find food that's nutritious.
And it's when one is sick and when one is a food food lover, like, that's one of the most devastating things, is to not even be able to enjoy, like, you know, for some of us, it's all we do is eat.
I'm with you.
So speaking of your mom and dad, your family takes garlic very seriously.
That's true. My parents, interestingly enough, live in central Ohio, a very rural place. Garlic has found its way into the book in so many different ways, shapes, and form. Mom and dad grow hundreds of garlic plants a year.
I love garlic.
Are lucky enough to grow a family heirloom that came from my dad's dad.
That's ridiculous.
Great uncle's garden. Probably my dad's grandfather is the person who brought it from Italy. And it has a really great story. You know, we incorporate garlic into V is for vegetable in a full-on chapter on garlic. And yeah, it's has become a fascinating story in the hands of one of our friends and farmers, Jim Roble, who works with us outside of Utica, New York, in growing this family heirloom. So we've learned a lot in the kind of humble process of understanding how to protect a family heirloom and how to celebrate it.
Some people have jewels, other people have garlic bulbs. Are we allowed to mention your wife's family's exposure to garlic?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, some people are used to having garlic in their home as a staple, and others are not. You know, I can't imagine cooking when it's not there, and sometimes we just have to remember that it needs to be explicitly added to the shopping list. But mentioning my wife, I was so proud of Mindy and her drawings that were included as illustrations in this book. They make for the end pages and then a very interesting through line throughout the book of all of these hand-drawn vegetables that have personality and character and ultimately express this quality of looking at each one of these vegetables with a sense of fascination, kind of inquisitively. There's a bit of enamorment that happens when you're looking at something that, whether it's familiar or brand new, that comes in the way. Her eye that captures the shadow and the light was really astounding, and I was so happy that we were able to talk her into collaborating with us on this book.
She had to be talked into it.
She had done a series of vegetables that just cropped up on her own. She's a painter and a wonderful drawer, and we have some of her work framed on the wall. And yeah, it took a little nudging and a little promising to cook and to be extra present in the household, but she agreed, and it's a gorgeous part of the book. It goes wonderfully as a juxtaposition with the 19th century French botanicals, which make up the chapter heads of each one of these chapters, and we were lucky enough to obtain the rights to these gorgeous old botanical prints, and then the handiwork of laying this book out in such an incredible, incredibly smart way helps people to follow the story. It really is about telling story of each of these vegetables through. The stories that I tell are not botanical stories. This is not a book about encyclopedic information. It's about, you know, the times that I kind of discovered these vegetables on my own and some of the surprising things that happened. It's about flavors that I have fallen in love with. And it's also useful information of sometimes here's how to, you know, unzip or tackle a vegetable that might be daunting in and of itself. I mean, a whole head of artichoke is kind of like, what the heck do you do with this thing? And I think when people feel a little bit more confident about, you know, how to handle that on a timely basis and how to turn something that ultimately seems unapproachable into food, and not just food, but something really delicious, I think this book was made for, you know, for that effort.
How did you meet your wife?
We met, ironically, over dinner. We were in this very humble restaurant in New York City called Per Se. It was claimed not to be a setup.
So you were just hanging out at Per Se with a couple
of friends. My brother and sister-in-law were friends before I ever met my wife.
Ah.
And the uh, it, the fact that we hit it off now makes for a great place to celebrate anniversaries.
That's a very stylish setup.
It's a family that loves to eat and drink, and you know, it's really wonderful when, you know, when you love spending your time with your family.
So you sat in front of each other for like a whole tasting menu, and
we had enough time to get to know each other, let's put it that way.
Okay, interesting. So like, what was the conclusion at the end of that meal? Was it like, huh?
Yeah, it was like love at first sight. It was like, wow, this person's really cool.
I could have a lifetime's worth of tasting menus sitting in front of this person. I just thought it was real sweet that one time you mentioned, hey, when you know that you know you and your wife are artists in different ways, and when she says to you, hey, how do you come up with all these, this like infinity number of recipes and dishes? And it's just so, it's so incredible to have that mutual admiration.
You know, eating is a necessity, and in a sense, you know, this book was driven exactly by that. That sentiment is that, you know, one, it is not easy coming up with what to put on the table, and then, you know, let alone the time frame that most people have to cook food. So, you know, when we set out to do these dishes, I was thinking very carefully and even asking questions of like, hey, listen, based on, I have three kids, like, how in the world are, what are we going to feed them this week? And, you know, what have they eaten 2 days in a row? And like, how do you resist the, you know, the same pressure that every single parent feels, you know, with kids that refuse to eat or kids that only want snacks, or, you know, even kind of trying to instill a little bit of excitement in a normal night, a school night, a work night. Food in this book tells the story of like literally how to make a little celebration out of it. I don't tell people how to eat, and this is not a book for parents to say like, you know, your kids have to eat vegetables or they're, you know, they're not going to make it through 12th grade. It's about sharing a little bit of knowledge and reconnecting people with their kitchens.
So the corn soup with avocado and coconut milk is really a rad recipe because it is gluten-free and dairy-free with all of these good fats without ever saying anything. You wrote the Gramercy Tavern cookbook while recovering from open heart surgery. You know, speaking of health,
that's true.
It was important that these two processes coincided for you, right?
Well, in a way, you know, I can't say that, you know, what happened to me was related to the way I eat, but I will say that recovering from any you know, serious health issue allows you to pause for a moment, think carefully about how to prioritize your life, recognize that, you know, sometimes we owe it to our family and friends to sleep a little extra, that this notion of driving ourselves to exhaustion is really not the you know, best path for success. If you don't have any energy to give to your team or to give to your loved ones, who will? So the notion of kind of paying attention to sleeping a little bit more, and then not necessarily changing how I eat, but focusing on not skipping meals. And in a way, this book gives recipes that break out of the norm of the iconic American meal, kind of sitting on a plate with a large piece of protein in the center and a few little pieces of some, you know, overcooked vegetable on the side, which doesn't have much to do with the story. This is the reverse of it. It's the idea of taking the vegetable as the star of the show, not sacrificing the way we love to eat. I include dishes that have meat and fish in them, but really saying that it's the proportion of the food. And in some ways, if we think about it, a lot of these dishes end up in a bowl. If we only thought of the American meal, the iconic American meal in a bowl, in some ways it puts a lot of our food issues in proportion and straightens out the way we think about food. So that's what drove the ideas in this book.
We've got time for couple of last questions. When you took the helm at Gramercy Tavern, for those of us who were not there in that moment and maybe don't know the incredible history of the place, like, what was the restaurant like at that time, and what was the challenge before you?
Well, Gramercy Tavern is you know, one of the most beloved restaurants in the history of our industry, and it was famous for doing so many firsts. It was Danny Danny Meyer's second restaurant, created with Tom Colicchio. And the restaurant, with the team of people that it pulled together, created an energy and a philosophy and the framework for what has become known as enlightened hospitality, and a way of taking care of each other, a way of seeing our work as being 49% filled with technical skills, 51% about emotional skills, the way we leave people feeling at the end of the day. And stepping into such a well-understood story could have been a little daunting, but it was a well-scripted entry. I did not have to live up to anyone's expectations except for my own. I had fun. I enjoyed working with Nick Ander, who was then a sous chef in the restaurant, who it felt like meeting a best pal at summer camp. And Nick and I had never worked before we joined together to work together at Gramercy Tavern. And it was he was in a great bridge for me in terms of getting accustomed to the way that restaurant works. A real treat. And at the end of the day, having enough room to make autonomous decisions to follow, you know, my passion for cooking foods from this region and cooking menus that say something about what's different about eating in New York compared to eating in other regions around the world. And then ultimately feeling a sense of pride of all of the folks that have ever worked there that have used that restaurant as a springboard to push their careers forward.
It's ridiculous. Maysville, Dover, all of these tremendous restaurants have the DNA of Gramercy Tavern.
Untitled. Studio Cafe.
You've got an event coming up, the 92nd Street Y. You're in conversation with John T. Edge, the founder of the Southern Foodways Alliance.
An amazing local hero.
Incredible.
Wonderful writer.
What's going on? How do we get tickets?
You buy tickets through the 92nd Street Y. We're going to be talking about the release of Vias for Vegetables on that night. The 27th is the publication date of the book. We're encouraging folks to come out and hang out and listen to John T., who has changed the way we look about food, think about food, especially in the South, but how that relates to us in a regional manner. And John has probing questions, an intelligent approach to our contemporary culture, some of our excesses, some of our passions, all in the way it relates to food. And I cannot think of someone who I'd be more excited with to spend an evening talking about food, tasting food, maybe even drinking a little bit of bourbon. He's a real hero of mine, and I'm so flattered that he decided to come and spend the 27th with us at the 92nd Street Y.
What time does it start?
Early on. We'll be there at 7 o'clock. And yeah, everybody, come on out. We'd love to see you.
Can I make two observations about you?
Sure.
Before my last question.
You are
really great at you're filled with vision and values. You answered every single question with the meaning of it for you. I just noticed that about you. And then you're really good at you're very well media trained. You're very good at skirting questions about garlic.
Come on, I'm not even sitting up straight yet.
And
I'm even better at eating pizza.
So it's so awesome to have you on. I just you rock. What is your dream job? Let's say you weren't good at cooking. What else would you be doing? Let's just pretend in another life.
First of all, I'm doing my dream job.
I
that
know,
is for sure.
And you can't say that. That's a boring answer. Okay,
you
we're
know,
here to entertain.
If I'm completely enamored with I have some friends who work for travel companies and publications, and those folks know how to travel. When you see their posts about traveling, they don't mess around. Life would be good if I were able to write about food and wine from a lot of different places around the world. That would be a real treat.
Oh, well, you could do that for my travel company, Journey.
Let's work this out.
It's called GoJourney.com. Yeah, shameless plug. And
there you go.
Actually, one final fun fact about Chef Mike that, you know, I've heard around town is that he's got a really special way of managing his kitchen. Like, some chefs yell. That's like a stereotype. And Chef Michael just, like, creep up behind you and make you feel like the world's worst human being for messing that up. And he just has this, like, incredible...
My wife calls it that look.
The look. Okay. An incredible present. So thank you so much, Michael. I'm not even going to let you answer that. I just wanted to put that out there.
I really appreciate you inviting me today. I had a good time. Thanks a lot.
At the top of the show, we had Lydia Bastianich on Cooking for Pope Francis. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern every Wednesday, word of mouth on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. Next week, we'll have live in studio Mads Refslund, co-founder of Noma, chef at Acne, on his cookbook he's working on, all about trash cooking trash food, and fine dining, and a fine dining restaurant he's got in the works. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.